Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Yeah, thanks very much, colleagues, and you know, thank you very much for coming this morning. Really, it's you know, it's a good and you know, good crowd here, isn't it, to actually talk about what is a key issue for us in terms of actually going forward for young people. And that's kind of, you know, I make no apologies about this. I'm going to talk solely about young people. That's our remit within the Young People's Learning Agency. So I'm going to kind of confine my comments to young people 16 to 19, and I'm going to talk less about the apprenticeship programme itself, and I'm going to talk more about preparing young people, because kind of I think the most worrying part of what I heard this morning was, you know, and I've heard it before obviously, is that actually from Simon, is that actually employers don't want to take on young people, and what we need to do is actually make sure and find out why it is that employers don't want to take on more young people. And, you know, I'll kind of be naively optimistic on this, is what can we do within the education system and the education and skills and training business to actually improve the calibre of those young people, to enable them to move on. So it's all about, for me, it's all about progression, it's all about pathways, and it's all about improving those access for young people. I'm going to pick up particularly on two aspects. One is obviously Wolf Review, because that's hugely significant, isn't it, in terms of the way vocational learning is going at the moment. And the second one, very much about, which we haven't heard so much about, which is about social mobility and about improving access for disadvantaged learners, and particularly to a work-based learning and vocational route. And the reason for that is very much, you know, not necessarily about whether that's right or wrong, but what is very much a reality now, which is that disadvantaged young people and those people who are socioeconomically disadvantaged are those young people who are in vocational learning and who do want an apprenticeship. So I'm going to look at some stats there and look to see how we can improve it. Now, as you kind of heard from my introduction, I've spent 20 years working in schools, so, and I've worked in guidance as well, so I kind of know how difficult it is. And, you know, the role now for the Young People's Learning Agency, in case you're not sure, it's a kind of possibly one of the shortest-lived quangos that's been around, which is that we are only established last April 2010, and we finish next April, which is April 2012. So kind of in terms of an arm's-length body, that's a fairly short period. Our role is to fund young people's learning, that's 16 to 19 young people's learning, and also increasingly to fund the expanding academies and free schools programme. So we are very much involved in that. We're not, just in case I get any tricky questions at the end, we're no longer really involved in policy. That's very much Department for Education, and what we do is implement Department for Education policy. So I'm going to kind of slip off the hook if the questions get too difficult at the end. And just finally, in the introduction, because we are in a quango and in the sort of, you know, the worst and darkest periods of the bonfire of the quangos last year, you know, and we were unsure about whether the YPLA would continue or not, one of the things kind of I guess everybody does at some point in their careers is to actually go through, you know, you're thinking about where's my future, and I'm going through a kind of list of, get my sheet of A4 paper out and work out, okay, so what are the skills I've got if this doesn't come to anything? So I went through my list of skills, and number one was a comprehensive knowledge of 14 to 19 learning. Now, of course, that's not hugely useful in the current climate, so I kind of got rid of that one. My second one was that I know the name of my son and his birthday, which actually is quite useful because he's always expecting some sort of additional funding on that particular date. That one was quite good. My third one was who won the cup in 1969, which is not very useful. Plus, the only reason I know that is because my team that I support lost in that, which says a bit about working in the civil service at the moment, doesn't it? And then my fourth one is a comprehensive knowledge of 1950s, 60s and 70s films. And I thought this might be helpful because I know there's that good quango, the UK Film Council, available, and I might go for a job there. But strangely, that one's gone as well, hasn't it? So I'm kind of stuck with it. But you know, what I do like to use is a very hefty metaphor for what I want to talk about. And the title I've chosen here is I Know Where I'm Going, which I think is a good, you know, it gives two meanings, really, isn't it? It's about young people and where they want to go. They often do know where they want to go, but often they don't seem to be able to get there. And the second reason is it is a fantastic 1945 film. Now, this is also very helpful because I've brought the DVD with me, and if it gets too painful, I'll just put this on, okay, and you can watch that for the remaining 10 minutes. But it's a 1945 film, and just in case, I hope nobody's got this out of Blockbuster, because I'm going to spoil the plot for you. Nobody's got it out of Blockbuster to watch tonight, have they? No, I'm surprised, actually. Basically, it tells the story of this character called Joan Webster, who has always known, I think she was described in the time of 1945 as headstrong. I think we'd call her assertive now, but she's always known where she wants to go. And where she wants to go at the moment, her life's mapped out for her. And where she's going at the moment is she's going to a Scottish island to marry a wealthy industrialist. He's the chairman of Consolidated Chemical Industries on a Scottish island, a kind of early example of employer engagement. Yeah, that's all right. They don't get any worse than that. So she's on her way to Scotland, and suffice to say, without spoiling the whole story, on her route there, she has a combination of kind of rather bizarre and lurid dreams. There's some really cataclysmic weather, and of course also the charms of an impecunious naval officer played by Roger Livesey, as seen in the picture there. And suffice to say, because of those competing difficulties, she actually never gets to the island at all, and she never gets to be married. And it's a bit of an inconclusive ending. We don't know whether it's a happy ending or not, but she's actually persuaded that rather than in pursuit of wealth, she'll pursue happiness. But we don't know where they're going to go at the end. They meet up at the end. They do go off together, but we don't know whether that's a happy ending or not. And the point of that, and bear with me on this, honestly, it does pay off at the end. When they were asked, the directors, this is Emmerich Pressburger and Michael Powell in 1945, what is this film about? This was their answer. It's a film about a girl who can't reach an island, and by the time she can, she no longer wants to. Now, the position for many of our vocational learners is the opposite, isn't it? They know where they want to go, they change their minds, and by the time they actually then decide where they want to go to, they can't get there. It's too late. They've chosen the wrong options earlier on. They can't get through to what they want to do. Now, to put it another way, my other great interest, and really you do need to bear with me on this, is rather than films, is roads. And this is a picture of the M1 in about the 1950s. And this, again, represents for me those pathways through. And strangely, this is the pathway for me, because it's a 1950s picture, of young people going through what's called the Royal Route. In other words, they take their O-levels, now GCSEs, good batch of those, they know what those are. They then go on to take A-levels, they know what those are, they know where they're going to get them. And then they go on to university, and again, they know what those best ones are. Now, that route is called the Royal Route. It has been the same since the 1950s. It's dead easy. Now, for those people who are vocational learners, it looks very much like this. And I'm really pleased to know that sort of Coventry people are actually here listening. So there's a welcome here to Coventry people, because this features the Coventry Ring Road. And actually, Coventry is a fantastic place. It's where I work. But it's so good because it's got two ring roads, an inner ring road and an outer ring road. This is the inner ring road. And as well as films, my big interest is ring roads. And I've got a list. You know, if it comes to one of these Channel 5 programmes, my choice would be, for a Saturday night, 100 greatest ring roads, not 100 greatest love songs. And I've actually made this offer to people before, is that I'll talk to them about my 100 greatest ring roads in order. But strangely, nobody's taken me up on that offer. And perhaps somebody could tell me afterwards why not. But in time-honoured fashion, I'm going to give you my top three. And number three is Lincoln. And Lincoln Ring Road is really good because by the time, if you're heading from the south and you want to get to the cathedral, it takes you so far out of Lincoln that at some point you go through Northumberland to actually get back to Lincoln. Number two is Bradford. And my colleagues who work in Yorkshire for the YPLA tell me this is absolutely true. It's that the Ring Road there has got so many roundabouts and so many traffic lights that Emily Bronte wrote the whole of Wuthering Heights trying to get home one evening. But my favourite, absolute favourite, number one, has to be Coventry in a ring road. And the reason I've chosen that one is it's regularly voted the scariest road in Britain. And the reason for that is that kind of it's built in the 1960s and there's traffic going round 40 miles an hour. There's really short runoff periods and too many exits, and actually it is a really dangerous road if you drive it. And I know a number of people actually do, you know, construct their journeys to avoid it. But, and this is how it does relate to young people, don't stick with me on this one, is that there are two ways of coping with that. One of which, and I come in the morning in, when I'm driving into Coventry, I come in around about 7:30, and I look across, and I see all these people going round and round. And I come, I'm leaving again about 5:30, and see all these people going round and round, and they are the same people. And again, that's how it is for a number of our young learners who want to get to apprenticeships, who want to get through vocational learning. They're going round in circles again and again and again. And then the other way to do it is I come in again at 7:30, look across, and there's actually people driving around with their eyes closed. It's the only way to do it. And again, that's how it is for many young people, isn't it? They're taking a lucky dip, really, to get to exactly where they want to go. And we have to do it better. We have to get better at this. Okay, so how does it look? I kind of want to pick up on six things. Before I do that, again, not a film, this one. This is Goya's Colossus. Well, I say it's Goya's Colossus because actually it's not. You know, they worked out last year that it hangs in the Prado in Madrid. But actually, it was painted not by Goya, but by his apprentice, a man called Ascenso Julia. Now, you know, kind of one of the things we always do, don't we, in this country, is beat ourselves up about lack of higher level skills. Well, the way they worked out in the Prado that actually this wasn't painted by Goya was they saw in the bottom right-hand side the initials, AJ. Now, kind of, you know, it's not sort of rocket science, is it? But I kind of would look at that first of all, wouldn't you, to work out who's painted it? But there we go. And actually, it's not. It is Goya's Colossus, not the chairman of Brentford wondering where his missing 10,000 crowd has gone. But there we go. So these are the kind of six key themes, I think, for us. And I'll run through some of these for you. Wolf Review, as I said, is critical to where this is. The kind of government concept of freedom, fairness, responsibility, and how important it is for autonomy for providers, and it is you as colleges, schools, academies, to actually make some of those decisions about what those routes are. Key issue of social mobility and disadvantage and how to improve that. The question we've already had here, and I'm probably sure it will come at the end, about good information. How do we get good information to young people about apprenticeship, about those vocational pathways and routes? It is a jungle out there. About university technical colleges, those UTCs that are on the horizon, and studio schools, and ultimately, and I think this is the key message through a lot of government policy, particularly for Wolf. If you want to put one word against Wolf, it's about progression and progression to the next stage and to positive outcomes. And that's not... To me, that's not just higher education. That's to skilled employment, further education, and higher education. And I'll do some more about that at the end. So, sticking with my film theme, who's afraid of this review? There are some good bits to it. And this is the bit in the introduction which I always like and think is really important. That a lot of the things that were said in it, don't necessarily have to agree to it, but what is clear is actually the system, as it was constructed, could not continue. So, you know, first point, we do need to change. Her criticisms of vocational education, I won't spend too long time on this because I think we know these things about 16 and 17-year-olds churning between employment and short-term employment and education, all these things about piling up qualifications for the wrong reasons. And this is particularly the case, isn't it, in terms of vocational learning. The themes and the response that's already come this summer from the government is very much to accept every single recommendation of the Wolf Report and the Wolf Review and to focus it down onto three key themes, which we've heard something of this morning. So the one about apprenticeships at the bottom, very much those ones about simplification. I'll not go into those anymore. The ones about trying to get rid of the kind of gaming that went on in terms of qualifications, both for schools in terms of performance and for colleges to a certain extent, with regard to funding, to see how we can change and move away from those. And of course, that key issue about literacy, numeracy, and as Wolf sees it, and I'll come back to this, about English and maths and English and maths GCSE. So in terms of English and maths GCSE, the stats there, less than 50%. Well, that's what it says in the report. It's slightly more, I think. I think it's about 53.4%. But a lack of any... young people post-16 actually picking up English and Maths GCSE, which we can see where some of this work with apprenticeships is coming from. The statement from the review, key skills is in no way no real sense equivalent to GCSEs to which they are formally linked, and therefore they should be a required component post 16. And that's backed up very much by the recent CBI report, isn't it, about two-thirds of employers, a pressing need for that. And I'm not sure anyone would disagree with that and the need to have, you know, improve our literacy and numeracy skills of young people. Now, as I said, I wanted also to talk to you about the disadvantaged young people. And as I said, that's very much about the here and now, because it's those young people who are socioeconomically disadvantaged who are clustered, first of all, in levels 1 and 2, secondly, in FE colleges, and thirdly, in vocational learning. So that's why apprenticeships is such a key issue and does need to be linked here. And again, high government policy and statements here. First of all, from Michael Gove there, we have to make opportunity more equal. And this bit at the bottom, which I always like, it's a unique sadness of our time that we have one of the most stratified and segregated school systems in the developed world. And secondly, from Nick Clegg, launching the social mobility strategy, which came out in the middle of the summer here, life chances narrowed far too many by circumstances of birth. So in other words, it's about worth, not birth. And that's there as high priority for government and high priority for us within the YPLA. Now, just so some of those, the data that's there narrowing the gap, they're kind of small here for you to see it, but it says, you know, this is from a government report earlier this year from the social mobility strategy. Children from disadvantaged backgrounds, less likely than their better off peers to reach the expected level of attainment. And that's every single point throughout their school career, right from Key Stage 1 right through to HE and university. And not just worse, but in terms of the number of times worse, this graph shows you the number of times that a disadvantaged young person, I'm measuring this by free school meals, which is the measure government uses, which relates to around 16% of the population. So those young people are 3 times less, roughly, and that goes all the way through. It's worst, you'll not be surprised, at Key Stage 4, narrows slightly, but it is 3 times all the way through. So just to remember that, free school meals child has around 3 times worse odds at every single point of their school career. Now, the film, of course, a bit of audience participation is Kez. And of course, you know, he could do whatever he wanted to do as long as it was go down the pit. And how does that relate to disadvantaged young people and raising aspirations and looking at alternatives? A number of issues there. National Career Service, we've heard something of. You know, Susan Pember this morning described how that will help. The Brown Report into Higher Education talked about individualised careers advice. We need to improve those pathways to apprenticeship. I'll come on to those in a minute. And Wolf, who I think was a little bit light on information advice and guidance, just saying, I would simply wish to reiterate its importance. I think she could have said a bit more to support us and help us on that one. But alas, the story too often is this one, isn't it? When we're looking at apprenticeships and work-based learning, they only tell you sixth form is available at my school. I knew there was other stuff, but that's all they tell us. And I think, you know, from the question this morning, we need to work very closely. There is some positive, you know, I'm a kind of naively optimistic person, that some aspects of careers education and guidance are there for us to work and to improve and to work with schools and say, here are some opportunities around work-based learning, around apprenticeships, around vocational learning. And we need to make that loud and clear, and we need to make sure that people understand that. And there's some good stuff that is there that local authorities have done through an LGA Communities of Practice website, if people want the links, just to see how we can actually get that started. And how does that new landscape begin to look? And when I talked about freedom, responsibility and fairness, this is from our statutory guidance at the top there. So in terms of actually delivery of programmes, it is very much down to individual institutions, to schools, to colleges, to academies, to devise their own curriculum. I know there's kind of things that are about league tables and performance tables, but it is your choice to deliver what is best for you and for your young people in your area. That's a clear government message. That's the responsibility. And one feature of this is these new developing university technical colleges. And those people who are working in areas where they are to be developed, 13 recently announced, there's 3 already opening next year, 1 already open. But there could be kind of really iconic institutions in Silverstone and various other places. They could be iconic. They are there for students 14 to 19, and already a couple of the ones that I've worked with are very keen to develop apprenticeships, to work with employers to deliver apprenticeships in those high technical areas that they're working with, and engineering being some of those. So look and work with those if you've got them in your particular area. Okay, so kind of getting towards some of the sort of the things in terms of where it is we need to go. I've press ganged William Blake into action here, who often is seen as a bit anti kind of enlightenment, but I think what he was encouraging is innovation and creativity. And I've chosen again William Blake because he again was an apprentice, and I'll tell you about his apprentice experience from 1772, I think it was. William was apprenticed to James Bazar of Great Queen Street, Lincoln's Inn Fields. The 14-year-old Blake promised not to fornicate or marry, not to game or dice, and not to haunt taverns or playhouses for the duration of his apprenticeship. On his side, Bazar promised to teach him engraving and feed him and clothe him for the next 7 years. Now, fortunately, things have moved on a bit, haven't they, in apprenticeships? I'm not sure always, as we've heard this morning, that some people's knowledge of apprenticeships has moved forward very much in those kind of 250-odd years. But, you know, what I'd like to us to think is actually we have a good story, a good message about apprenticeships. We have young people who want to become an apprenticeship. We need to make sure the systems in terms of information, advice and guidance, in terms of the curriculum, fits them. So what do we need to look at? Now, first of all, this to me, I don't deal very much with graphs, as you can imagine, but this one I really like because on the blocks there give you the numbers of young people in each year, so from 2002 through to 2014 and 15. And as you can see, the actual number of young people, 16 to 18-year-olds, is dropping. Now, at the same time, we have this ambition of raising participation age and increasing participation anyway. And clearly, the message of that one is to say that in terms of recruiting, and we're thinking back here to our pictures of the royal route as opposed to a route into apprenticeships or vocational learning, it's very much that those young people that we now need to recruit in the here and now, 16 to 18-year-olds, are those who are not in the system and those who have more and specialised needs and those who are disadvantaged. So those are the young people we need to work, and we need to put something there and offer there for those young people, and we need to provide those pathways for those young people so that they will be employed. My second one is about the value of vocational learning. And I think, you know, this is from the Equalities and Human Rights Commission from 2009. There is evidence, isn't there, that it does improve motivation and more engagement with more formal learning. And I'm going to put you there, David Cameron's statement here about university technical skills. First-class technical skills to those turned off by purely academic study. Okay, and we've heard the question earlier, haven't we, about good information, good advice, good guidance. It is an absolute priority, and it is very much for us to try and design and work collaboratively and locally to make sure that that does work. This is from a colleague from a piece of research done in Peterborough, and you could see this statement anywhere, couldn't you, in terms of how much this information is available. It all seems to focus on one particular area. We need to get much better at that. There is an opportunity, but it does take some pushing to get there. Oh, and I've come to an end. Help. I've only got one more. Can anyone push this on for me? Oh, here we go. Oh, I've gone too far. There, here we go. I'll let you read that one for yourselves, because it's... And I expect, you know, once you've read that, you might sit there nodding away thinking, yes, that's absolutely right. The little bit at the bottom that you might not be able to read tells you when it was written, in 1963. It could be, couldn't it? It could be the introduction to any white paper we could publish now. But it was written in 1963. And the title of that white paper then was Half Our Future. And colleagues, It still is half our future. It's half our future who don't go on to higher education. The proportion of young people getting 5 A stars to C, including English and maths, 53.4%. That's half our future deemed at 16 to be failing. That's why we need to get it right now. In terms of going back to William Blake, his poem was called Hear the Voice. And I don't know if you know that one, it's called the start of it. Hear the voice of the bard who past, present and future sees. Now really, we've had something about the past, we've had something about the future, but it is those young people in the here and now that we have to get this system right for. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.